So, good morning, everybody. Again, as each week, first action item is, do you have any questions concerning the slides we did last time? Okay, it's not really many slides we did last week, but the week before we had plenty of them. So, are there any questions, anything you want to discuss? Not? Everything clear? This is what I would hope. If everything is unclear, okay, I know then it's difficult to ask questions as well. Please then make your point that you got completely lost. Okay, if I don't hear anything, my assumption is everything is clear. Okay? Then today I think I first should continue a little bit with the lecture, because I assume for the two exercises we have to discuss, they were due for today, it's good to have a little bit more background. So I first continue with the lecture. So, what you see here is my perspective, how I believe computers are built. And of course, it's not only that I believe it, it's really the way it's done. Of course, somehow abstract. So, at the bottom of this picture, you see the first person constructing a computer. So, he had books, he had maybe other tools, and he built a first computer, a first PC, for example. This could be N.G. Lehmann, N.J. Lehmann in German, who did that here in Dresden in around 1956. So he did. So the person does. Then maybe we have a second person. This is from Button, the second person writing a program, because a computer is pretty useless without any program running on that computer. And then I assume that this program is executed on the computer. Maybe then a third person from below uses the first program running on the computer to write a second program, which may run on the same computer. And then I could continue that way. And finally, we get a circle in the sense that sooner or later, the program being developed and executed will be a CAD program, a computer-aided design program, being used to design the next generation of computers. So, at the top, you see a fourth person designing the next generation computer using a program, a tool, running on the first generation computer. Now, of course, we can generalize, it will continue that way. So, we are using the tools we just created to generate the next generation of computers and tools. And this principle makes up the huge pace of development within information technology. If we would have to design computers by hand, even today, we never ever could build such powerful computers as we did. So how do we do it? We use tools running on the generation before. Okay. Now, I have to admit that the world is slightly more complicated, because the computer you do the programming on is not necessarily the computer the program will be executed on later. So here I make a distinction between program development and program execution. So two additional computers make it to the scenery, and they are the computers the two programs are executed on. And now the interesting question is, if, for example, we have an error in the design of the computer at the top, who did do that error? The obvious answer, and this is the answer everybody comes up first with, is, hey, if we have a design error in the topmost computer, then the person designing that computer made an error. So it would be the topmost person. So this is what usually people believe. Can be. But it can be different. For example, it could be that the person at the bottom, and this is what I depicted on the slide, made an error in designing the first generation computer. This error made it into the programs and only manifests itself later, only gets detected later in the design of the second generation computer. So this is one possibility. So now it's a completely different person who made the error. There are many other ways it could happen. It could happen that with the computer at the right-hand side, at the bottom, there was a small glitch in executing some program. Maybe a storage cell, the value of a storage cell flipped, whatever, for whatever reason, the program wasn't executed correctly. So an error did happen. That error made it in the other program. That other program, the tool used to design the next generation computer, was error-prone. It contained an error which wasn't detected at that time, and this error made it into the next generation hardware. So, until now, I only did talk about errors. And even there, you see some kind of transitivity. Why? Because we use the former generation of hardware and software to design the next generation of hardware and software. So, if we have some errors in the former generation, these errors might make it into the next generation. There's not a necessity that they make it, but they might make it. Maybe errors are detected quite soon. If it's too obvious, maybe they are dormant for quite some time and only manifest themselves, are only detected quite late. And according to Murphy's Law, of course, you will detect them in the most unpleasant situation at the most unpleasant time. Okay. So this is probably one of the reasons everybody of us so really enjoys depending on computers, right? They work all the time when you don't need them, really. And if you really need them, then okay. Surprise, surprise. Probably this is something which happened to most of you. So what I just described in terms of error, being that a human being errs, quite natural. Nobody's perfect, right? Even engineers aren't perfect, so they shouldn't pretend they are. And of course, the execution of programs, machinery, physical machinery, never will be perfect. It's physics. Things happen maybe with a high probability, and hopefully we build computers that everything works fine with high probability. If you go to the extreme, hopefully it really works fine with very high probability, but it's not perfect. So errors are a concern. And now if you get into security, it even gets worse. Human beings are not perfect. I even would argue, with respect to precision, they are less perfect than digital machinery. They have a free will. Sometimes they are very tired, so they make errors. And because of their free will, if money or pressure is involved, they might make errors intentionally. Who is interested in that errors are made? It depends. Hidden errors, hidden functionality, usually is called a Trojan horse. We'll come to that in more detail later. So, if errors can propagate transitively, so can Trojan horses. So, if I manage to implement a Trojan horse in the bottom line computer, that Trojan horse could have an influence on the programs developed on that computer, on the programs executed on that computer, and so on and so forth. So, Trojan horses might propagate along the lines of tools. So, if the functionality of your computer, if the security of your computer depends on the tools used for its construction, which is the case if you cannot check your computer completely, and given the complexity of today's computers, it's very hard, and I would argue at the moment it's nearly impossible to do a complete check. If you can't do a complete check, you rely on that the tools used for the design are correct. They don't contain errors and Trojan horses. And secondly, you rely on that the persons doing the design don't make errors and don't have bad intentions. Bad intentions, of course, from your point of view. If an engineer, let's say, in nation X, gets paid by the Secret Service of nation X to implant a Trojan horse doing good service for the Secret Service of nation X, maybe this engineer is a hero for nation X, but maybe it's not a hero for nation Y. If these tools, if these computers are sold to nation Y and used there. You get the point? I hope. So, relying on computers at the moment means you are relying on an awful large history of computers. Many, many people had an influence on your computer, on its hardware construction, on its software, and so on and so forth. So this is a problem. I have to admit, it's really a hard problem. I don't have an easy solution. We'll get to some partial solutions, but there's no easy solution which completely solves the problem. What I think is not a good idea with respect to security is to say, hey, this is a hard program, or sorry, this is a hard problem, so let's better ignore it completely. And this is what many people do. And this is what even the military does. At least it did it in the past. In the meantime, colleagues and me are slightly successful telling the military, hey, can you really rely on the computers you are using? What should you check? And after explaining that to them, the question comes, hey, and what should we do? And then it gets tough. Let's go to the Trojan horse in more detail. You know the story of the Trojan horse? There was a town called Troja. It's long in the past, and usually males had some struggle. And if males have struggle, usually it's about women, right? So if it's about real struggle. So some Greeks wanted to get back a woman, which the inhabitants of Troja didn't want to give back. So the Greeks made it to Troja and tried to get into the town. And they didn't succeed in the straight way. By the way, usually if someone comes to you and say, please hand over all the data of your computer to the Secret Service, then probably this would be not a success if you do it directly, right? Probably you wouldn't hand over your data, right? At least I hope. At least not to foreign secret services. Maybe you hand it over to the local police, but hopefully not to a secret service. Even a domestic secret service is not allowed to come to you and ask for your data, right? It's only the police. So the Greeks had the feeling, okay, if you want to have the success, we need to be clever. Physical force alone won't do. So they had an idea, and they built a wooden, huge horse. They put some Greek soldiers into that horse, and the rest of the Greeks left, right? So the Trojans, the inhabitants of Troja, were quite happy. They said, okay, the war is over, and they left back this wooden Trojan horse. So let's get it into our town, just as a sign of victory. Usually if you're installing a program, you're quite proud if it's running finally on your computer. Okay, so they get it into town. And at night, if nobody checks what this horse is doing, nobody had the feeling that there are any checks needed. A wooden horse, even if it's large, is not really a threat for a town, isn't it? So nobody was there checking what it really did. By the way, if you are executing a program in your computer, are you really checking what it does? So the story goes that then the Greeks left the Trojan horse, got out, and opened the gates of the town. The other Greeks did not really leave. They just tried to get out of sight and came back. And so the town Troja was taken, and the Greek woman made it back to Greece. What was the real purpose of this whole war. So this is the old story. Please, why did I tell it to you? First, sometimes it's funny how long we know some truth. We know that for more than 2,000 years. And often truth, even well-known, old truth, are forgotten or ignored. So this is the first point I want to make. It's really an old story. Secondly, within the Trojan horse, there have been Greeks, no Trojans. So if you are talking, my computer got a Trojan, then it's nonsense. You might tell your computer got some Greeks. Or you might tell you have a Trojan horse on your computer. But you haven't Trojans on your computer if you listen to the history. Maybe this subtle difference should be explained to Microsoft. They have the completely wrong terminology in their advertisements. Maybe there's some confusion what's good and what's bad, but okay, this is another story. So, on your computer, you have programs, and maybe some of them contain functionality you don't know and you don't want. What could that Trojan horse do? It could use so-called covert channels. Channels which you can use for transferring information, but usually you are not aware that these are channels, so they are covered. They are not easily visible. So a Trojan horse might use covered output channels to transmit information. So what might happen is unauthorized disclosure of information. You may think of timing information. You might think of complicated ways of doing some coding. It could be the power consumption of your computer, which is the channel to the outside world. There are many, many possibilities. Some covert channels have a tremendous bandwidth, that is megabit per second. Other covert channels have only very low bandwidth, maybe a few bits per hour. Usually, people tend to say, hey, if it's only a few bit per hour, then we might ignore it. Because how long does it take to transmit a few megabytes if bandwidth is a few bits per hour? Okay. If the attacker's intention is to get a few megabytes, then it may take too long. But if it's about cryptographic keys, maybe a key has 200 bits or even 100 bits only, then getting 1 bit per hour may be enough just to break your system in a shorter time than a week. Okay, so you see, the bandwidth of covert channels is an issue. Even if it might be small, it might be an issue for some kinds of data. Of course, for Hollywood protecting the movies directly, it wouldn't be an issue if it's 1 bit per hour. Second kind of threat, write access. The Trojan horse might use all writes to write into files, into data, for unauthorized modification of information. That is, going to the extreme, a Trojan horse just might write garbage into your file system, which, by the way, is a more dramatic thing than just erasing your files. In particular, it gets a problem if it does so not too much. Just starting, let's say, writing nonsense in a file once an hour. Not writing too much nonsense, but writing a little bit nonsense. Let's say replacing each zero by a nine at random. Then usually it will take you a long time before you struggle over it. Much of your data has been polluted. And probably the usual way of doing recovery doesn't work. Would you say, hey, I got that program a year ago, so I use my backups just to roll back all my data for a complete year? Probably you couldn't afford that, because you would lose all the work you did during the year. So modification of data is particularly a problem if it happens to be slowly and randomly, because then there's no easy strategy to purge your data. Third threat. The Trojan horse might use write access, non-termination, or resource consumption just to change functionality. That is to withhold information and resources. By overwriting programs, functionality is changed. By modifying programs, functionality is changed. By non-termination, for programs, for algorithms which are expected to terminate, you're doing some kind of denial of service attack. Or you might just consume resources which other processes which run then don't have available. So this is what a Trojan horse might do. In computer science, Trojan horses are of course not known for thousands of years, because computer science is not thousands of years old. Okay, maybe some parts of algorithmics are a few thousand years old, but okay, this is a different kind of lecture. Computing technology as we know it today is not so old. So a discussion about computer Trojan horses started, let's say, 1960, 1965, something around that. So in the meantime, it's known at least 40 years, maybe it's 50 years, quite some time. Not brand new. So do you have the feeling what you have on the screen now is the worst possible situation? Maybe you have. Should we do a vote? Okay, if you're asking that way, then probably the answer is no. It's not the worst possible thing you have on screen now. What could we do to make it even more worse? Okay, sure. Yes, I assume the Trojan horse does some selection combination of functionality. Yes. And of course we could combine the Trojan horse with this kind of transitivity we just had on the slide before. So maybe it's enough that you pollute by a Trojan horse hardware or operating system, and then because of interpretation this Trojan horse makes it into some of your application programs, at least into the execution of some of your application programs. Okay? But if we look at that level, if we only focus on that Trojan horse, could we make it worse? assume you have it that way, what would happen? You read the code of the Trojan horse, or if it's a hardware, you look into the functionality and you see, hey, if I look at it precisely, it does make up or use a channel, it overrides or modifies some data, it's using resources in ways it shouldn't do. You see it, if you look carefully enough, if you understand what is done, and then maybe you say, hey, so the creator of that piece of software, of that piece of hardware, has bad intentions, right? So, in the future, we won't use programs or hardware from that source, right? If you ever find it. Secondly, if the author or the producer of that kind of software hardware is under your jurisdiction here, you could sue it. If there's some kind of arrangement with another nation state, that you could sue it under that jurisdiction, which usually works fine as long as the person or the entity in that other nation state didn't do it for the purpose of the Secret Service, because then usually they get immunity. So not really a way then to cover claims, to get back your money, to get compensation. So, to making a long story short, if you use a Trojan horse as depicted here, if it's detected, then it's pretty clear it's a Trojan horse. It's not useful, at least not for you executing it. Maybe it may be extremely useful for NSA, Mossad, KGB, or whatever the names of secret services are. So, okay, then you get a mic, because if it's two ideas, then it's really a good idea to hear it.
So, the first idea was how to make it worse. We could have multiple Trojan horses, which use maybe the same channels or mess around with the same data, and we could be unable to foresee the consequences of them mixing their functionality.
Okay.
And the other idea was if the Trojan horse is embedded in a software which I cannot stop using. Maybe it takes me out of business to lose my CAD software, and the firm that created it for me is long out of business, and I detected that Trojan horse and there's nobody enabling me to remove it or sue somebody. Or
okay, so having a Trojan horse embedded, let's say, into whole families of Intel processors or in Windows functionality would be a good idea. Not from the German perspective, but maybe from other nations' perspective. How to avoid them. And even AMD, as far as I know, is an American company, right? Okay. But still, nobody proposed what I think is now the extension which makes it much more difficult. You learn something about Turing machines, right, in theoretical computer science. And then people, theoreticians, thought about, hey, is there something like a universal Turing machine, a Turing machine which could emulate all other Turing machines? If so, we have a very powerful tool for building up theory and doing some analysis, etc., etc., etc. Nice. And now Dorothy Denning, I think it was in 1984, had the idea, hey, Can we bring that idea to Trojan horses? Can we build a Trojan horse which can emulate all other Trojan horses? The answer is, it depends. What we then need for the Trojan horse, for the universal Trojan horse, is some kind of input, what it should do. In other words, which particular Trojan horse it should emulate. So a universal Trojan horse should have inputs, again about a covert input channel. So it receives commands what to do, and then it does. Doing it that way has at least two advantages. First, if you can communicate with the Trojan horse, with the universal Trojan horse, because you can read the output, so this was unauthorized disclosure of information, so it has some kind of giving output. You give it commands, so you have some way of communicating with the universal Trojan horse. So you can make your attacks much more specific. If I want to kill politician O and not others, I can communicate with the Trojan horse, hey, is this a file giving medication of politician O? And if so, please replace each 0 by a 9 or whatever. And the interesting point now is, hey, I have not to make a decision which politician to kill at the time I'm implementing the Trojan horse. And it may make or need some time until the Trojan horse, by transitivity, gets at the place I want it to be. It's only then, when it's at the place I want it to be, or where's a good opportunity, that I have to decide whom to kill and whom not. So it can be much more specific. And secondly, a universal Trojan horse comes pretty close to well-established purposes and uses. So it gets quite common that you do something on another person's computers, maybe without asking for an okay. I just tell you a story. As I mentioned, and this is not fiction, it's true. As I told you, switching centers, private computerized branch exchanges, are controlled by computers. Okay. The software on those machines got more and more complicated. So even that software contained errors. So you could bring it by operating your computerized telephone switch in a situation where it broke down, where you needed help. Where do you get help? You get help by the company or from the company which sold you the switch. In very former times, this meant that the company did send an employee to your premises to help you, which means the help starts quite a many hours after you called them, because the person has to get to your company, to your premises. So when computers got connected, and of course computerized telephone exchanges are connected by definition, they switch telephone channels, so they are online all the time. The idea is quite apparent. Hey, instead of sending a person to your premises, could we have a technician log in into your switch remotely and help you with getting the mess sorted out, undoing some of your configuration instructions, maybe installing a new version of some of the programs you are using. First, if you hear that, you will have the feeling, hey, this is a very good idea, right? It saves a lot of time. At second thought, probably you think, hey, this is an awful bad idea, because it means that the company I sold the telephone switch from has a login into my computer. It can monitor what I do. It can install and deinstall software. Usually it can bypass all the security within my switch, if there's any at all. This is a bad idea. Now if people like me give talks to companies running that kind of switches, what will they do? They will disable remote maintenance. Of course, if you sell that, if you have a nice new feature, you should build it in a way that you can disable it. Okay, so some company disabled that. They disabled remote maintenance. What happened sooner or later? Nevertheless, they got problems. They had disabled remote maintenance, and they had so much trouble that they were not even able to enable remote maintenance again. So an employee of the company selling switches had to travel to that company, which lasted for some while. And now that company had a splendid good idea. The idea was, okay, we have one access to the computer for remote maintenance they can disable. So if they like, they disable it and they feel good. But let's have a second hidden covert access to our switches, so we can do remote maintenance even in case they disabled the official possibility to do remote maintenance. They will love us for that, because in case of an emergency, we can help them much faster. In my terminology, now we are talking about a universal Trojan horse. And on the one hand, we would say, hey, this is a company which really is interested in serving its clients, giving good service. This is one way to see it. And the other way to see it is, hey, this is a flavor of organized crime. Both use can be maintained, both use can be backed up legally. So the point I want to make is, in a Trojan horse, if you're talking about Trojan horses, it's pretty clear what it does and if it's good or bad. Good and bad, of course, depends on the viewpoint of the person you're asking, but given this viewpoint is clear, okay, good or bad. With the universal Trojan horse, it depends. It got more flexible. It can be used for good and bad. So, if you ever in your life decide or have to decide how to do a Trojan horse, I would strongly suggest that you do it universal. First, because then mainly you have to do it only once, and then you can do more interesting work, because now it's universal. And okay. And secondly, if you do it universal, it's much harder to blame you for any bad intentions, because it can be used for some good purposes as well, which is nice. But of course it can be used for some bad purposes. But then you can argue, oh, this is just bad luck. And nearly each engineering tool I can use for bad purposes. You can use an ordinary knife to cut meat which is already dead, and you can cut your neighbor, still alive, at least in the beginning. So it's not really a surprise. Engineering tools can be used for good and bad. A knife usually is such a dual-use tool. It's used, it had many good purposes, and of course it has some, I would argue, less good purposes. Of course, if you are a soldier and if you are killing some other soldiers using your knife, maybe you are a hero, but okay. So I'm very careful and say less good purposes. Of course, maybe there are other engineering tools where you would say the purpose is much more specific than with a knife, which is somehow usable in many ways. Okay, so far the universal Trojan horse. Any questions to that? Okay, then we proceed. Yes? You want me to go back? Can be, yes, maybe. But it's not really clear. In a special Trojan horse, you have to put into the Trojan horse all the decision procedure, what to do under what purpose or under what situation. So there may be a lot of analysis code about the surrounding, the data in that Trojan horse. With the universal Trojan horse, you can not have that code and just rely on the commands, or maybe you can load that part of the code later on. So to make a comparison, you have to spell out at what time and what kind of analysis of situations must be done. If you give the mic to him, then maybe easier for all of us.
So covert Trojan horse is universal Trojan horse is harder, yeah? Covert.
Yes. I would say building it, implementing it requires more thought, because you have to do some kind of coding for the input. You have to foresee that maybe some additional functionality should be downloadable later on. So the Trojan horse might be in a position that it evolves over time. So, of course, now we can say, hey, how much let's say, science, or how much thought do we put into Trojan horses? And of course, this kind of evolvement, you could even discuss here. If you build a Trojan horse, it's now somehow an autonomous device which might evolve. If we are talking about universal Trojan horses, it's not completely autonomous. It's controlled by some entity giving instructions. So this was a long answer to your question, and probably the short answer would have been, it depends. Please react if you like.
I have one question. Can universal Trojan horse can be consist for two or three special Trojan horse for some computers?
Yes.
Consist.
For example, I wouldn't call it a Trojan horse, a universal Trojan horse. I think a universal Trojan horse is just more than having several Trojan horses somehow interacting. I think universal means you have input and you have a kind of Trojan horse engine which enables all kinds of attacks. That is, gives you access to all available covert channels, gives you possibility to write into each file you have access to, and to consume resources whenever you like to, within the limits which are, let's say, set by the operating system you run on. Okay, just to give you a feeling, with this distinction between Trojan horse and universal Trojan horse, we could start a complete lecture about just this topic. And this is something I don't do. First, maybe it's not my area of expertise. Secondly, it's not that I want you to educate to some kind of general purpose haggle. This is not my aim in education. All I wanted to raise is some awareness. I want to give you a feeling, hey, these problems are there. So if you later on talk about security, you have a feeling against what kind of attacks we should try to defend our system. So in some sense, I can live with the fact that at the moment we have not really a precise definition what is a universal horse in contrast to a non-universal Trojan horse. It's just that I want to give you some feeling, some idea. Okay. If you talk about security, we had first an introduction into protection codes. It was confidentiality, integrity, availability. And secondly, I said, okay, we have to spell out against whom are we protecting. And for the background of Trojan horses, you can elaborate on that question. Against whom do we need protection? To start simple, we surely have to protect against laws and forces of nature. So components, mechanical, electronic components, are growing old. Sometimes we might have excess voltage. This might be lightning, which happens from time to time. Or it might be an EMP, an electromagnetic pulse, which hopefully doesn't happen too often. So EMP just means you have an atomic bomb being ignited at high altitude. So mainly the destruction is at the ground, is not physical destruction, too much heat, things like that. But mainly what happens is you have a huge electromagnetic field which usually destroys all electronic devices in the light of sight. So whenever you can see the bomb exploding from all the machinery, all the electronics in this area is completely destroyed. Which of course means that if providing fresh water, if distributing food depends on computers, depends on logistics, which only works with the computers running, then any civilization relying on that kind of computers has a real problem after an EMP. The military, by the way, tried to harden their systems against EMP. Hopefully they succeeded slightly, but nearly all the civilian systems would have a real problem. So if this happens, no communication, no TV, nothing. No electricity, no water after someone. Maybe I should tell you some story about that. I was brought up in the western part of Germany. So when I was a child, our parents told us, your enemies are in the eastern part of Germany and the Russians, of course.
Right.
Okay. So we had a feeling, okay, these are really threatening persons. Okay. And probably at the other side of the wall, same story. Okay. So they had the feeling. We were threatened. And then I remember that from time to time, the military pays a lot of cash to people within the other force just to get over to them using, taking with them high-tech military equipment. So I remember that sometimes a Russian pilot flying a MiG aircraft fighter, the most modern MiG aircraft fighter, made it to America, not to attack them, but to land on an Air Force base and handing over the plane to the Americans. And probably he got a lot of money, he got a new identity, etc., etc., etc. And then the Americans started, of course, to do some analysis, what are the capabilities of this Russian aircraft fighter, how did they build it. Okay, so the good story is, know your enemies, know what they can do. And after some months, in the German newspapers you could read, hey, these Russians are technologically way behind the Americans. Within their most modern aircraft fighter, no semiconductor electronics at all. They built their most modern aircraft fighter using light bulbs instead of transistors. So all our fears are not grounded, have no real value behind them. They are just not state of the art. So this is what you could read in the Western press. Some people who know something about physics perceived that completely differently. They said, oh, we really have a problem. They build aircraft fighters in a way that those fighters can operate in a situation where normal electronics is completely destroyed. They can operate in a situation where EMPs happen. So the Russians built their planes, the military planes, that they can operate during a war, during a serious war. Okay. So EMP is not fantasy. At that time, probably it was 1990s, something like that, the Russians would have been well in a position to use transistors in their plane. No doubt about that. But for very good reason they didn't. So, just to make a long story short, within this lecture probably you will get many, many, many remarks what you might do to improve security. This EMP story is one of the areas where I have no good solution, because I cannot come up with the proposal, hey, let's avoid transistors for civil applications. Let's go back to light bulbs. So there's a problem. And probably, if you read now the newspapers about other nations' weapons and other nations' nuclear programs, then please keep in mind that the threat may not be that a nuclear weapon of your worst enemy hits one of your capitals. The most situation is that it's going to explode well above your country. And this, by the way, is much harder to avoid, because you can, of course, try to interfere with incoming missiles around some larger cities, but at large altitude, within the light of sun, okay, it's much harder. Okay. So far, X is voltage. You can have the inverse thing, no power, voltage loss. What do you do against that? Use some batteries. Within each laptop you have it, right? Great. And of course your servers should have some battery pack. How long should it last? It depends. What is usual in servers? Okay, if you have some, yes, yes. Okay. Hopefully, if you have a hospital, they have it. For, let's say, organizations like TU Dresden, we haven't. So, how much time reserve, how much capacity do you usually have? So a laptop, usually a few hours. A server, 10, 20 minutes. If you go to the extreme, 1 hour. The last power outage here in this building lasted slightly more than 1 hour. So all the servers crashed. So some people started to shut down the servers after 10 minutes. Some other people decided, oh, longer than an hour, we don't believe that. So let's wait. And they waited until it was too late to shut down the server ordinarily. Then water may be a problem. What you usually hear as some rules about how to build a computing center is, hey, put it into the basement. Then it's much harder to attack by bombs, because the basement usually, hey, this is where the concrete is. So, but of course the problem is, if you have too much water in your area, then probably it will be in your basement. For some technology, huge changes of temperature might be an issue. Okay. But if you do it well, and with the exception of EMP, there's not really a good way or a simple way to do it, by using usual fault tolerance techniques, you can prepare for laws and forces of nature. And by the way, an EMP is not an act of God. It's not purely an act of nature. It's some people behind it. But of course, I'm talking about a physical phenomenon, EMP, and therefore I listed it there. So assuming we have done that well, and whenever you are running an infrastructure, whenever you are accountable for what you do. Please think about all these issues. It doesn't make sense to have headaches about universal Trojan horses and transitive Trojan horses if you don't care for water, electricity, power, right? And now it gets more demanding intellectually, human beings. First story is, please keep in mind, at least until today, you cannot look into another person's head. You can't. By the way, I would argue that this is a quite happy situation and nothing to be changed. But which way we evaluate, at the moment you can't. By the way, if you think about you personally, maybe you can somehow look inside your head and you can, if you like, try to understand how you feel today, what your motives are today. But even for yourself, saying how you will feel in 10 years' time, that whether you will tend to the extreme left-wing parties or the extreme right-wing parties, or what kind of odd fantasies you might have, probably you don't know. So, if you are talking about human beings, we have to accept that we don't know what they think at the moment. And even for people where we have the feeling we know them well, it's really hard guessing what they will think and do in 10 years' time. It's really hard, and I would say it's impossible. So whenever it comes to human beings, we need some kind of organization, we need some kind of system construction that we don't depend on single individuals, because we have no way to know what they will do. Probably this never will change. So please, never ever build systems, please never ever use system where the running of the system, the security of the system depends on single persons. You shouldn't do that. Having said this, let's consider different roles human beings might take with respect to particular systems. A person could be an outsider. An outsider is a person who has nothing to do with the system. So what do? You just make sure he has no way to interact with the system. Maybe a fence, maybe an electric fence, maybe barbed wire, or maybe a lot of roses looks nicer and mainly has the same effect as Barbara. May even be good for your CO2, let's say, level of political correctness of your company. Roses are better than Barbara. So, but however you do it, outsiders should be kept outside physically. And it's usually not enough just to put in a sign, outsiders, please stop here. This is not enough. The next category is users. Just ordinary users of your system. Obviously, you can't keep them off your system. So somehow they do interact with your system. What you should make sure is that for each user, it's well defined what that person might do and what it might not. So having users who can do anything within your system probably isn't a splendid good idea. Because if you do it that way, then any user running crazy ruins your system and your data. Next, usually you have operators of your system running it. As we learned about human beings, you have no clue seeing into the heads of your operators. So if you're a company or if you're a country, those people running the infrastructure of your company or your country, hey, are you sure they are working only for you? Are you sure they are never drunk? Are you sure they have no bad intentions? Okay. Service and maintenance. We know that in IT, from time to time, you need service and maintenance. Hardware grows old, has to be replaced, has to be maintained. And even more often, software has to be maintained. So you get a new version, where people giving you the new version, giving you a patch, will claim that it contains less bugs. If you think back historically, you say, or you should say, less bugs probably is not really the issue. It contains different bugs. Maybe this is closer to reality. So, service and maintenance is an issue. If you allow people to approach your computer and to change hardware, then usually those people can do everything with your machine, at least in that moment. If they want to destroy your machine, they do it because they are physically there. And if you think about universal Trojan horses, then usually destroying your machine wouldn't be done that I just go crazy and crash all your hardware. It might be, I'm just taking the wrong printed card and your machine crashes. And now I might argue, oh, I'm a human being, I just made an error and no bad intention, so please forgive me. With software, after software maintenance, usually you should really inspect all your software and the machine. After maintenance, usually, at least in theory, you can have a completely modified computer. So you should check it as if you had just procured it from scratch. Even the military, by the way, doesn't do that. But they should. Then you have the producer of your system. So that might implant Trojan horses. You have the designer of the system. Even before the producer producing it, the designer may have implanted a Trojan horse. And then usually both the producer and the designer not do it by hand, but they use tools to design and produce. So those tools might be Trojan horses, or maybe even universal ones. And now you see it gets recursive. And even it's worse. Because service and maintenance again uses some computers. And now you see it's an awful lot of people you depend on. Except you are able to fully control computer and its software you are using. So, what to do? If you look at risk analysis, if you look at how people behave with respect to human beings, then in a usual scenario, you are considering outsiders and users. So companies think about how to keep the outsiders out and how to restrict the users. That's it. Because after that, doing more, protecting against stronger attacker, really gets difficult, really gets expensive, really is hard to achieve. So maybe there's not a perfect solution. So many, many companies just ignore threats by operators of the system, service and maintenance, producers, designers. Okay, so maybe one thing I didn't depict in this graphics is, in explaining it, I gave you the impression that all these roles are taken by different people. And in reality, in smaller companies, or if you are talking about personal computers, it's just not the case. So usually, if you are the user of your computer, probably you are the operator of your laptop as well. Quite often you are service and maintenance. For some of the software on your computer, you may be the designer. Does this make the world easier or even more difficult? I would argue, on average, probably more difficult. First, if it's your computer and if it's your data, okay, if you know what you are doing, it's easier. Because probably you trust you, yourself, at least at this very moment. But if you are providing service for others, it makes life much worse. If all these roles of users, of operators, of service and maintenance are taken by different people, in some sense you can try to confine that service and maintenance may do some maintenance of the hardware, may do some maintenance with the operating system, but will do not any change on application data and application programs, for example. Now, if you have people doing operations, service maintenance, design, you cannot control these people. That is, a PC, a personal computer, can be, for those who know what they do, a very powerful tool and helping you keeping your security. But never ever I would trust what you do on your computer, because you are user, operator, service and maintenance, designer. Except I know you very well. I have the feeling I can look into your head, and I believe that you really know what you are doing on your machine. So please, you shouldn't trust what is going on my computer. I personally haven't enough knowledge to know everything what happens here. Hopefully you are more clever than I do. I am. Okay. So if you want to approach this problem field from an organizational perspective, then having the separation of roles and enforcing that is a starting point. As you said, in many situations, you have the same people, different roles, or even all these roles, and many of these roles, and this is a problem. Okay, further comments or questions? So next point is, which protection measures should we take against which attackers? And at the left-hand side, I have the different roles we just started with. If you start from the bottom line, outsiders, user of the system, operator of the system, service and maintenance, producer of the system, designer. So I'm going through more or less the layering of the system. Starting from the very bottom, of course, outsiders, it's very easy. It's about physics, then user, operator. In the middle of the slide and at the right-hand side, I do a distinction what we want to secure. What we do in the middle is we want to achieve the intended functionality. And at the right-hand side, we want to prevent the unintended functionality. So now I start at the bottom line. Against outsiders, what do we do? We protect the system physically. Walls of concrete, fences, no barbed wire, please, roses. So keep the potentially bad guys out. And if it's not about physics, of course, if we are talking about long distance lines, having walls and roses around them all the time doesn't work, it's too long, it's impossible to control that. So what you then do is you protect the data, the bits flowing on those lines, by cryptography. So by cryptography, we keep the outsiders out of the information, or away from the information of the bits. With respect to users of the system, we should restrict their physical and logical access. You shouldn't let your users into your main computer room. Please remember that. And if you don't let them physically into your main computer room, you should them let logically into your main computer without restricting them. A user shouldn't be able to do anything on your machines. Operator of the system. You should, if you want to control operators, restrict their physical access. If an operator can physically change the computer, he can do anything on that computer if he has enough time and dedication to do it. So if you want to protect against the operator, you need some kind of tamper-resistant housing for the computers. And you should, with respect to the operator of the system, restrict logical access. Even the operator should not be able to do anything. For example, the operator should not be able to read passwords of users, but maybe it's okay, it's a good idea if he can reset them. So even the operator shouldn't be in a position to read everything.
And a remark about that, what about the 4i principle? Like said, having two operators and controlling them?
Yes, for many situations, 4Eyes is a very good idea. So this is good to protect actions the operator should be capable of doing. Of course, even with the four eyes principle, avoid the two persons doing something, there's no need they do it. So reading user passwords just not needed, so only allowing them to be reset or to be set is sufficient. And of course, what the operator does has to be locked. Usually it's security critical, so it has to be locked. Of course, there's some tension with data protection, so even operators might claim some privacy, but if they are administrating the data of millions of users, then probably the privacy of the millions of users is more valued than the privacy of the operator. Okay. And the operator behaves hopefully professionally. He's paid for what he does, so he has to stand that his deeds are locked. Service and maintenance. After it happened, please keep in mind you have to control your computer now as if it were a new product, a new system. And we'll see if we go further to the top what this means. Producer of the system, if you want to check against that entity, you have to have an independent analysis of the product. And independent is an important notion. If someone gives you software and he also gives you the tools to analyze that software, then it gets really fun. If I give you some product containing a Trojan horse, and you ask me, please give me the tools to do some analysis, and I give you the tools for analysis, then of course I make sure that those tools for analysis never ever will find the Trojan horse, right? Otherwise I'm completely stupid. So, if you want to check the producer of something, you need independent tools for doing that check. Which, by the way, means that at least the interfaces of these tools, the main data structures, have to be known, because otherwise there's no way to do some independent development of the tools. If those things are not public, then company A could say, hey, company B wants to sell some tools for analysis of company A's software. Okay, we tell you the interfaces, but only if your software then behaves like we want you to behave. And again, no independence. So, a discussion we had about the open interfaces or even the source code being known to some people. This usually is a kind of prerequisite for that kind of independence. The design of the system, okay, either some analysis tools, as we will see in a minute, or make sure that you have several independent designers. So many software tools you can build that you have alternative versions, maybe a very efficient one, a less efficient one, you can let them run, you compare the results. And if you want to protect against designer and producer of the tools to design and produce, then what you need is some kind of intermediate languages and intermediate results and abilities to analyze these independently. And again, why is open source such a huge success? Because the units they build are usually small, so they really can be analyzed.
I also think open source helps a lot with the service and maintenance thing, because a service maintainer is in an open source world replaceable by another, and he has to do a good job and to convince me that he's doing a good job. Otherwise, I would look for somebody else, or at least I have the ability to take someone else and let him check if my original service maintainer did the right thing. Whereas with closed source, there's sometimes only one choice for the company who maintains yes. my server. Or
so I put it in my words. I started that I say, please don't believe me. Think about my arguments. And if the arguments are okay, then take it. With respect to software, we shouldn't have an attitude, hey, this is my software, please believe me. We should have an attitude, this is my software, please check. Okay. So maybe we are now in a good situation just to make a break. 20 minutes, then we continue. Okay. See you then. So, if we can restart. May I interrupt your interesting conversations, and let's try to have one larger conversation within this room, okay? So, this was the last slide, and I gave this slide to you just to give you an idea what we might do and how expensive it gets. So some things are quite easily to be done, so keep outsiders away from the system. This should be standard practice. Other actions like independent analysis of the product, that is, independent tools to analyze the product, this is often non-standard. Okay. In the next slide, it's the same content, but a little bit smaller. And now I want to relate some areas to each other. If you look at the brown area, that is protection against the operator of the system, the user of the system, and outsiders, then against all of them, physical distribution is a very good idea. So, for example, if you have operators of your system, if you have local operators within a computer center, then having parts of the data, copies of the programs, etc., at another center might be a splendid good idea, because it hinders the operators in this center having physical access to the programs, the computers, the data at another center. So physical distribution and redundancy is very important with respect to more physical threats. With respect to prevent the unintended, and prevent the unintended, this is mainly about confidentiality properties. So integrity, availability, this is mainly make sure that the intended functions are done, they happen. The unintended mainly is prevent people who should have no access to information having access to it. So confidentiality mainly is the issue in the green area. And in this part of the problem domain, unobservability, anonymity, and unlinkability are important properties. I'm just going to define them. So all of them help to make sure that the ability to gather unnecessary data is avoided. So what is the problem? The problem today is, if I have access to data, if I can gather it, how do I make sure that it's not gathered? If I have gathered it, how do I make sure that it's destroyed, that it's erased? So the most fundamental possibility to counter that kind of threat is to avoid the ability to gather unnecessary data. Surprisingly, many services can be built in a way that a lot of data, where usually people think they are necessary data, can be avoided. To give you ideas, we can build communication networks such that even the network operator has no clue who is communicating to whom. Usually everyone has the feeling that the network operator in a switched network has to know who communicates to whom because he does the switching. But this is not true. If you build it differently, the network operator doesn't get a clue who communicates to whom, which of course then makes data retention by the network operator not a splendid, clever idea. Because if the network operator can't interpret the data, then probably others who get it, in case of law enforcement or whatever, will have the same problem. So here, properties like anonymity, people, entities, are anonymous within a set of people and entities, is a nice thing. If the anonymity set is large, you can act under the protection of this anonymity set to good issues and to bad issues. You can use your protection by this anonymity cloud to stand up and say, hey, this politician is completely, what should I say, lying, corrupt, whatever. And probably this politician cannot do anything against it. So this is a good property, freedom of information, the ability to make your statements. Of course, a problem might be, if it's completely anonymous, why should I listen to it? There's so much noise on the internet, why should I listen to it? So probably it only gets useful if I do not just claim this politician is such and such, but I have some kind of evidence that this happens to be the case. For example, if I give an argument, hey, those politicians say they get down taxes, they will increase investments, and they will decrease debt of the country, then probably if you now think about basic laws of algebra, you know something is wrong. You cannot lower taxes, spend more money, and decrease debt of the country. Doesn't work. Okay. Unlinkability, I should mention a little bit. If you hear terms like anonymity, it's used by different people quite differently. I give you an example. Let's assume you buy, completely anonymous, a SIM card, a telephone card. Fine, you are anonymous, you have the SIM card. Let's assume you use it. You call your girlfriend or boyfriend, your parents, your sisters, your employer, whatever you do. Probably in the first call, You're pretty anonymous. Maybe you call your girlfriend, but you're not the only person on earth who knows your girlfriend. So you're still anonymous, let's say, in a set of a few thousand people who know your girlfriend. Now you call your brother using the same SIM card, and the two calls can be linked because both are issued by the same SIM card. So the network operator can link the two. He has no clue who you are, except that you first called your girlfriend and then you are calling your brother. Now, the resulting anonymity set is those persons who both know your girlfriend and your brother. Maybe this is only one person on earth. Maybe it's only you. Maybe it's still a few ten or a few hundred people. Now you call your employer. Let's assume it's a small company. And then you see it narrows down by the linkability. So a SIM card which you bought anonymously, after you used it for several actions which are linkable by the SIM card, usually in the end you haven't any anonymity at all. Still, people feel that they are completely anonymous because they never ever mention towards the network provider their name. But of course, this is now just an illusion. So the point I want to make is anonymity in the beginning is it's not enough. If you want to maintain it, you need in addition some kind of unlinkability of your actions. If your actions are linkable, then it's very easy to build up profiles. And after your profiles grow beyond some threshold, it's pretty clear it's you. You are the only person on earth who knows these other guys and wants to communicate to them in the example I used. So this was some kind of definition or dealing with anonymity and unlinkability. Unobservability could go even one step further as anonymity. With anonymity, usually we assume that the action which is done by a person we don't know still is seen. We know someone is calling your brother, or someone is calling your girlfriend. With unobservability, we could even go so far that there's no way to make sure whether communication just takes place. There are some techniques which provide that. So the point I want to make is, if you look in the middle column, integrity and availability, you remember the slide that there I said, hey, if something goes wrong, you will get to know. And if you are well prepared, you have your backup, you have a way to undo some transactions, then maybe you can repair what went wrong. With respect to confidentiality, I said, oh, it's really a problem. If something went wrong, usually there's no way to repair something. We cannot make a law, okay, we agree to forget that we once knew that, okay, it doesn't work. So for me, it's happy to know that the green area gives me an opportunity in the field of confidentiality. If I can avoid data to be gathered, because it cannot be gathered, then this gives me a very strong notion of maintaining confidentiality. So data you never had, you never could have, it's perfectly confidential. And this is the other side of the coin. Data you have, or you could have, it's really hard to convince anybody else that it's kept confidential. So probably, if you think about what I'm going to present to you, then of course in the next month, I will present to you an awful lot of standard techniques, standard security. But what is particular to me, to this kind of lecture, and maybe to me as a person, that I'm really interested in the green part. This is where I did the research I did during the last 25 years. And it's really amazing what we can achieve there. And later on in the lecture, mainly in spring and summer, you will have good examples what can be achieved there. What I touched several times last week and today is that I said we have to describe, we have to characterize somehow the maximal strength of the attacker we assume. And we call that attacker model. Some people feel attacker, it's a very strong notion. Let's call that adversary, or find other more polite names. I decided within this lecture to stay with the strong notion of attacker, and just making clear once that this is not a notion that the attacker is the bad guy, but the attacker is the guy challenging the security. And challenging security can be done for good and bad. So I take attacker purely as a technical notion. No ethics implied. No lawfulness or unlawfulness implied. It's just the entity working against the protection goal, challenging the security mechanisms. So why do we need some kind of attacker model? The best would be that we say we have protection goals and we're going to provide them. Period. Whenever we add we have protection goals and we're going to provide it against this and that attacker, first, the sentence gets longer, and secondly, this longer sentence is not as strong. It's much stronger if I say I'm going to provide this property, period, than if I say I provide that period against this and that. Because if I just say period, it means against every attacker. At least this is the usual meaning. Maybe some computer manufacturer would say, yeah, just make a period, it means I'm providing security against nobody. But okay, this is not the normal semantics of language. Some people call that legalese. So, why do we need an attacker model? The problem is, or the reason is, it's not possible to protect against an omnipotent attacker. We cannot protect anything against an all-powerful attacker. Therefore, a statement like, I will provide for this protection goal, period, it's just ridiculous. I can't do that. Nobody can do that. And if someone does a statement he or she cannot fulfill, it either tells you that this person does not understand what he is talking about, or he has some bad intentions. Maybe if you are looking for nice proverbs, there's a good sentence, I think it goes in the following way. if everybody around you loses their heads without you, then probably you don't appreciate the seriousness of the situation. So if some people tell you that security can be provided, full stop, protection can be provided, full stop, then probably they don't appreciate the seriousness of the situation. So, I'm not in favor of attacker models. I would like to live without them, providing security against all attackers, but I can't. So if I'm now talking about secure systems, I have to spell out against whom, which properties are secured. This makes the specification more lengthy, which is bad. But if I do it well, it might be a realistic description then. Okay, so what do we have to spell out if you're talking about attackers? First, the roles the attacker has. We had outsider, user, operator, service and maintenance, producer, designer. And of course, as we noted, these roles can be taken in combination, which usually makes it much more difficult to defend against. Secondly, we need to know the area of physical control of the attacker. In which area does the attacker exercise physical control? Meaning, he can tap, he can modify, he can do anything. Usually you would assume that a company X within its computing center exercises physical control. Usually with respect to your PC, at least if you have some, let's say, hacking capabilities, or no, let's say it positive, if you are really interested in exploring what your machine does, then probably with respect to your computer, your laptop, your desktop, you are in physical control of that machine. You can disassemble it, you can modify it, whatever. And Hollywood and others talking about digital rights management are not happy that this is the case. But let's be realistic. Who's really interested in what's going on in the machine will open the box and at least try to have a look inside it. Third area, behavior of the attacker. We can make a distinction whether the attacker is purely passive, he's just listening. Often, secret services, or curious neighbors fall into that class. Or maybe the attacker is active in the sense that it interacts with you, with your machinery, maybe even with you as a person. On the internet, there are many active attacks because we are interacting all the time. It's not too uncommon that you get some message and you react on it. Some people even send you a program and you execute it. Ever opened an attachment in your email? Sure that this isn't a program, but only data? Okay, think about it. Passive-active has nothing to do whether this is allowed or disallowed. It's just a description how entities behave. In some situations, it's interesting to make a distinction what is allowed and what is disallowed. Then an observing attacker is someone who keeps the rules. He only behaves as it is allowed. And a modifying attacker breaks rules. So usually secret services behave as observing attackers. They try not to break rules because usually they want to get unnoticed. Quite contrary, terrorists usually, at least in the final stage of their doing, want to break rules. They want to get publicity. This usually is something secret services don't enjoy much. So, depending on who is behind which entity, it could make sense to assume that some attackers behave observing, they adhere to the rules. And of course, in some situations, it has to be assumed that the attacker will break rules. Fourth property, is your attacker stupid or intelligent? Of course, it's easier to protect your system against stupid attackers. Yes, it is. But you never know whether someone really is stupid or if it only pretends to be stupid. Because he wants to make some joke of you, or because he wants to lull you into not taking that seriously. So my feeling is, you should assume that the attacker is intelligent. He knows what he does, he knows what he wants, and he acts according to some plans. Just to give you an idea that even if you don't behave intelligently as the attacker, intelligent behavior may arise. Yes, I give you an example. There have been times where computing equipment had not so much protection as today. Today, if you have a good machine, from an application program, you just can't write into the operating system. Inter processors and MD processors provide for that. You have hardware support, etc. There were times where you hadn't hardware support for memory management. So in principle, an application could write into the storage space of the operating system. At that time, designers of operating system did the following. They didn't have hardware support. So what they did do is, whenever they returned to the operating system, they just calculated the sum of the operating system, let's say mod 256 or something like that. And if it was the sum of the operating system which they expected, they assumed nothing has changed. Let's execute the operating system. So this was the assumption with the lack of hardware support. And now, if you think about what are the probabilities, if you don't do it mod 256, but let's say we take it mod 16 bits, so it's okay. So the probability that just by chance, after modification, it's still the same checksum of the operating system is quite small. And then they did a programming course at a computer center. And whenever the programming course used the machine crashed. Why? It took them quite a time to find out. Maybe you are faster. What are the first programs you usually write in a programming course? Okay, hello world, and then what is the second program you write? At least in my time, what we did write some sorting routine. And now probably the first people start to smile. So if now in your sorting routine, if you have an address error, so you are not sorting your data, but other parts of your machine, let's assume you are sorting the operating system. This may have a slight impact on the functionality of the operating system, but surely it hasn't any impact about the sum of the operating system if you are just summing up. Bad luck. So the students doing the programming, surely they didn't intend to attack anything. They were annoyed by the machine crashing all the time. They wanted to go home and have fun with their girlfriend or boyfriend or whatever they like, maybe cultural exercise. Okay, don't mind. So nevertheless, the behavior they produced by their error seemed to be intelligent behavior. Never ever the security mechanisms of calculating the checksum ever noticed any write into the operating system. Quite clever. So, to make a long story short, what I want to say is, if you have complex systems, even if you have very stupid errors, the consequence of a stupid error being implanted into a complex system can be seemingly intelligent behavior, which again gives me a good reason to say, hey, if we are planning for security, of course we have to assume that an attacker behaves intelligently. So, just to abstract, whenever someone comes to you and says, hey, I have some mechanism, in our example, summing up the operating system, and if I do something, if I change something, then please calculate the probability that by chance it has the expected outcome. Whenever someone argues that way, you have to challenge, why should I assume that this happens by chance? It can be determined. It can be intentional. So why should I assume that the usual statistics, the usual probabilities apply? Please be skeptical. This is the reason why I explain those stories and why I make so much fuss about the contradiction between stupid and intelligent. Okay? If, yes?
Hello. The term stupid also makes more sense if you think of the attacker as also he could be an insider or he could be the programmer. It could be yourself who may attack some properties of your system without knowing it, maybe.
So intelligent for me includes, maybe I should make that explicit in the slide, having a lot of information about the system. So usually, within an attack, first the attacker tries to gain as much information he wants to attack as possible. And of course, this is a downside with open source, that he gets nearly all the information about the system. But, okay. And then he tries to do conclusions from that information. Okay, let's assume we have agreed that attackers are assumed to be intelligent. Then, with respect to cryptography, computing capacity is an issue. If you want to be on the safe side, then you say, hey, I assume the computing capacity of the attacker is not restricted. He can calculate whatever, in principle, can be calculated. And this is the, let's say, safe assumption, and he can calculate it fast. With that kind of assumption, of course, you are always on the safe side. If you want to use cryptography, for example, like public key cryptography, usually you have to assume that the computing capacity of your attacker is restricted. He can calculate a lot, but two large problems he cannot handle. For example, he cannot factor, let's say, numbers 10,000 digits long. Of course, if you make that kind of assumption, and if you are serious, you have to monitor from then on whether this assumption is still valid. Because maybe the mathematicians produce much better algorithms to factor numbers. Maybe. Maybe the computer geeks, the computer architecture people, build much more capable computers. So better computing powers helps. So whenever you assume something about your attacker, for example, it's restricted in this way, then you have to keep current whether this assumption that the attacker is restricted is still valid. Okay. Just to make two final remarks, it's about money and time. Usually, your feeling, your naive feeling is money rules the world. So it's all about money. For money I can buy persons. So another sentence is, anybody is corrupt, it only depends upon the price. Okay, I'm not saying that this is true, but nearly everybody is corrupt and it only depends on the price. Maybe a true statement. So for money, usually you can buy people. You can buy insiders. For money, of course, you can buy computing equipment. For money, you can buy scientists doing good research in computer algorithms for factoring, for example. So the first appreciation you usually will have is money, this is what really is important. And in some sense, yes, that's true. But now I want to point out that particularly with respect to cryptography and particularly with respect to how much can be computed, maybe time is even more important than money. During the last 50 years, computing power you could buy per euro, per dollar, did grow, let's say it did double each 18 months. For simplicity, let's just assume it's doubling each 12 months, which in some phases was pretty close to reality. Then, what does it mean to have much more money to spend than someone else? Much more money could mean a factor of 10, a factor of 100, right? Okay. If computing capacity doubles each year, how long does it take before someone who has much less resources, less money, has the same computing capacity? Factor 100, so it's doubling, so first year, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64, now we have it. So after 7 years, a relatively poor attacker has the same computing capacity, a very powerful attacker, powerful with respect to money, had before that. So 7 years gives you a factor 100. 10 years gives you a factor 1,000. 20 years gives you a factor 1,000,000. Now if we are talking about keeping secrets, just to remind you, if it's about medical secrets, they should be kept for 80 years minimum. Think about what 80 years means in terms of money relationships. So, okay, money is important for characterizing an attacker. But sometimes if an attacker has just time to spend, he can just wait before he's going to attack your cryptography. Then time really is important. And then time, at least in the past, because of the exponential growth of computing capacity, outperforms money. Okay. One concept which is hard to understand, if I go back to this slide, is the difference between observing and modifying attackers. During the last years, I got many, many, many questions about that. So what do? I make another slide. This is the slide. Observing versus modifying attacker. First, left and right, I paint something which I call the world. And then I have area of physical control of the attacker and the IT system under consideration. Both are, of course, part of the world. And with respect to the IT system under consideration, it has some overlap with the area of physical control of the attacker. And if you are talking about an observing attacker, the assumption is that within the green part, that is, the IT system under consideration, except those parts the attacker has physical control of, within the green part, all rules are kept. So observing attacker means an attacker within the IT part of the world, which is not controlled by him or her, sticks to the rules. Then within the IT part of the world, the existence of this attacker cannot be noticed. He plays according to the rules. Within that part of the IT systems, other my control. A modifying attacker may break the rules everywhere. So completely yellow. The observing attacker may break the rules within his part of the IT system, because others have no access to that. They cannot notice. And in both situations, I don't talk about what's been done in the world. So I ignore the world. I assume there might be some rules broken in both situations. So this is my picture of observing versus modifying attacker. Can you pass the mic there? And
On the left side, the observing attacker is able to modify things in the area of his physical control because the IT system wouldn't notice, because he could...
It's IT system. You are allowed to modify, or you are able to modify your computers. Sure.
Okay, so this applies to like his personal PC in a network?
Yes,
and
yes, yes. So, just to make a point, I do not want to discuss at the moment, but for example, Hollywood would like it to be true. Hollywood would like to have that within our computers, there are parts we cannot modify for digital rights management. And in this picture, I assume that within the area of physical control, anybody can modify anything. And you will assume, or you will see, that this is a very safe assumption, in the sense that if on this assumption I can build secure systems overall, then I'm on the safe side. If I would assume that within the area of your physical control, you cannot modify something, then this would be a daring assumption. Because if you can, my assumption is wrong, which could break the security of the system.
So for instance, if the IT system has certain policies that also apply to my personal PC in the network, then this would mean that the policies fall under an area that is not under my physical control? Or?
If there are policies, I would assume that the attacker sticks to the policies outside his part of the system, but may violate these policies within his part of the system.
But this is like
pretty close to what we do with our head. Let's assume we agree to some kind of policies, how we interact with each other, right? Let's assume we agree to a policy, let's be polite to each other, let's be friendly to each other, okay, right? Now you interact with me and you see, hey, he's polite, he behaves nice. But you have no clue whether I think in the back of my head, oh, this is a complete idiot I'm talking to. Of course I behave nice because this is the protocol we agreed to. So this is the difference. I assume that an observing attacker plays nice toward the outside world. But what he does in his head, in his computers, may be completely against the interests of the rest of the world. And for many, many situations, this comes pretty close.
But this means that the area of physical control in this model is always obscured from the view of the IT system.
Yes. Yes. And if you're looking about or building a distributed system, again, I play it at the human level, American style, we meet. You ask me, how do you do? How do you feel? This is the usual initiation protocol if you meet an American. And of course, the answer is pretty clear. You have to say, I'm fine. If you say something differently, it's breaking the rules of politeness. You cannot say, oh, I have a problem. I'm just divorced. My mother died. And I've seriously got a cold. No American will be interested in hearing that. So, okay, how do you do? I feel fine. So, again, with respect to this kind of attacker, in a distributed system, you can, of course, ask the computers of the attackers some questions. And the point I want to make, they will answer the questions like you want to hear the answer. How do you feel? I feel fine. This is what you want to hear. Again, there are some technology people, buzzwords are trusted platform modules, trusted computing, who try to build technology which gives you a possibility to interact with some parts within my IT infrastructure, making sure that you cannot be lied at. You really get the answers. But this assumes that I am not capable of modifying those parts within my part of the system. And this, at least in the past, was an assumption which was wrong in the long run. Therefore, I don't want to make it. Okay, further questions? Okay, let's first go there and then there. Okay.
Could you please give a simple example of the observing attacker and a modifying attacker?
An observing attacker for me would be a secret service. They don't want to get the rest of the world notice that there is any secret service. And a modifying attacker, it could be terrorists, and it could be any entity who wants to demonstrate that they have influence and power. So North Korea wants to demonstrate that they have the capability of launching missiles, of having atomic bombs, and to break some rules. And this is, at the moment, the feeling of their leaders, how they could make money. Because just asking, hey, dear US Americans, if you want us to behave in a way you like us to, then better give us a lot of money, at least for our leaders. That many people within North Korea are just dying because they have nothing to eat, this doesn't bother too much their political leaders. So this, okay.
And so here is depicted that the area of physical control of the attacker is some part of IT system, yeah? Like it is a part of IT system.
So I would say that just this part is part of the IT system, and this would be a part of the attacker area which is outside IT.
And can the observing attacker be just on the border of IT system? Like just to hear something, you don't need to come into the room. You might stay just near the entrance.
In my picture, I would always assume that an attacker has some equipment, some IT, and some means of non-IT, some wetware, some human being, some organizational means, whatever.
Is it supposed that the equipment of the observing attacker is a part of IT system? So what I mean, for instance,
some may be connected to other IT systems, yes.
But
I would assume, maybe I should make that explicitly. Usually, I assume some autonomy of IT systems, of IT subsystems. That is, in my, let's say, explanations with respect to human beings, I assumed, I'm autonomous. He's asking me, how do you feel? And I autonomously decided, hey, I'm going to play according to the rules. So I will answer, I feel fine. Completely ignoring how I really feel. So this is my kind of autonomy to say, I know the rules. Of course, I know my internal state. And now I decide what answer I give. And my autonomy against him is that he may ask me questions. And if I decide to answer them, he gets my answers. But he has no way of seeing how I really feel. And this is the same with computers. Within a distributed system, I assume you can send queries to other guys' computers. May you get an answer or not? You could even ask them, hey, could you please tell me which operating you are running? And then you get something like, okay, I'm running macOS 10.6 point something. They say, hey, I'm not sure whether you are lying or not. Could you send me the binary? And then, of course, I can send you the binary. And I even could send you the 10.6 point something binary in case I don't run it. So in this sense, I assume autonomy, that the outside world has no way to check whether answers really reflect the internal state, the true internal state, or whether they are just fake.
About the physical thing, suggest we have 50 computers and the IT system. And they are like roughly managed by the management, I don't know. Does it consider that the attacker, observing attacker, might be operating a part of these 50 computers? Or it has its own special equipment to connect to and to listen? That was I meaning about the question.
I would assume that the attacker controls part of the systems, So I would say all the computers in the world might be connected, so in some sense they form a large system, mm-hmm. and parts of this system is controlled by the attacker. This is what I wanted to express.
Okay.
So, to sum up a little bit, security in computer networks, now I take a particular system, a computer network, what shall it mean? Confidentiality then means message content is confidential and sender and recipient are anonymous. What does integrity mean? Integrity means detect forgery. If messages are forged, this should be detected. It should mean that the recipient can prove transmission, can prove that he has sent something. The sender can prove transmission. The sender can prove, oh, transmission is not really good. Okay, depends. He can prove reception in this sense, which of course assumes that someone else did transmit something. And usually, if it's not free of charge, then ensure that the service is paid for. Availability means enable communication. So what would we do? For message confidentiality, we would use end-to-end encryption. For anonymous sending or receiving, we would use mechanisms to protect traffic data. I'll come to that in the spring and summer term. For integrity, we would use authentication systems to spot forgery. For recipient, let's say, ability or recipient's ability to prove transmission, messages should be signed, digitally signed. Then you can prove that someone has sent them and signed them. To prove that a message has been transmitted to you, you should get or issue a receipt. And payment, in the easiest of all worlds, you are just paying as you use the service during usage. Because if you pay before, you never know whether you get the service. And if you pay after, the service provider never gets or knows whether he will be paid for. Availability, you should use diverse networks in the sense that cable and radio is combined, maybe different operating systems and communication protocols are combined, just to avoid any single point of failure. And usually in communication, resource sharing is an issue. If many people want to communicate, you want to make sure that everyone gets a fair share. So fair sharing of resources is important. So this could be a first overview. What of course happens is, if you have a closer look, you will see several kinds of refinement. For example, if we go with our computer network towards mobile networks, then it's not only a question of message content and sender and recipient anonymity, also the place is important, from where is communicated to where is communicated. And if you look at integrity, it's also interesting, when did you get it? When did you send it? So time is an issue. With respect to buying stocks, it may heavily depend whether you placed your order half an hour earlier or later. Okay, so far, first overview. We'll get to all of these details later on. Next area. Here, or maybe I go back a little bit, if you're talking about attackers, your feeling will be, often the starting point will be attackers are the bad guys. In some situations, attackers are the good guys. If I have a computer, maybe I hire some attackers just to challenge the security on my computer. So I just come back to, hey, what's good, what's it's bad. And whenever someone tells you, there's a very, very simple rule to say those guys are good and those guys are bad, then usually I would say someone is cheating. So the security people for a long time framed what they do, hey, we, the security people, are the good guys, and we are helping the good guys to defend against the bad guys. Sounds nice. Sounds as if you want to get good payment, then you should argue that way, right? And maybe if you have the feeling that open societies are fighting against terrorists, or framing it differently, societies adhering to a power monopoly, that is, the state has a monopoly with respect to physical power, fighting against people who say we don't respect that, we are just exercising power for our own, be it terrorists, be it organized crime, then in some sense I would say, okay, maybe the fight of the good guys against the bad guys may be an appropriate way to describe that. But even there may be doubts, because the heroes of the past who got democracy into place often have been the terrorists at that time as seen by the kings. But okay. But nevertheless, okay, there are situations where good against bad may be a reasonable description. Still, I have some doubts. If you look at civilian applications, often that kind of framing the problem is completely nonsense. If you are a bank, you are a client of the bank, neither of you is bad by definition, neither of you is good by definition. What you just have is different interests. If you are a bank, you want to earn money, you will give some kind of service, but mainly you want to earn money. And if we are talking about capitalism, then it's your main purpose to earn money. You are not a charity organization. You have to earn money, otherwise you go bankrupt. If you are a user of the bank, you want to get a good service at minimum price. You want, if possible, to get your risks shifted to the bank. Of course, the bank is usually much more clever than single users. They have a law department, so they will do whatever they can to shift their risks to the clients. And if you look at the real world, then I would say in the past, banks have been tremendously successful. So I shouldn't say one is good, one is bad. I just have to say you are playing different roles. Service provider, service consumer, organization, private person. It's not about good and bad. You are different. You have different interests. And this brought some colleagues and me together that we said, hey, we should look for some kind of new definition of security. Traditionally, we had the military hire the computer experts and framing everything they did within the framework of the fight of the good guys against the bad guys. But if you look at society, at a pluralistic society, this framing is just nonsense. It's not good against bad. It's different people, different role players, interacting with each other, in some sense cooperating, but still having different interests, and assuming that they want to pursue their different interests. If you could get the bank pay you, let's say, $2,000, but charging your account only $1,000, nearly everyone would say, hey, this is nice, it's okay, I enjoyed that. And I wouldn't call you a bad guy just because you take a gift of $1,000. So, a new framework for security. And we call that multilateral security, in the sense that we want to reflect that there are multi-parties, many parties, which are usually interacting with each other within a large application or system. And we want that the security interests, the protection goals of all those parties are taken into consideration. So we started with four main statements. First statement was, each party has its particular protection goals. In other words, we say, interests are not uniform. Each actor is particular. He has his particular protection goals. Second statement is, each party can formulate its protection goals. Third statement, security conflicts are recognized and compromises negotiated. Fourth statement, each party can enforce its protection goals within the agreed compromise. And if we can provide for all that, then first it gives us some feeling of fairness. And it gives us overall security with minimal assumptions about others. Coming back to my example of the bank, of course you can get client of a bank just assuming, hey, the bank, this is in some sense the successor of my parents. The bank will care for me as a client, it will protect me, it will only sell me stocks if it's really good stocks, and bank will make sure that I'm not cheated at. Sounds somewhat naive. Nice dream. If you look at the relationship between client and bank in this multilateral security scenario, it's pretty clear the bank has interests and the client has interests. It's not the same. The bank surely is able to formulate its protection goals. This is what they usually do in the fine print. In Germany, at least in Europe, I should say in Europe, they are changing the fine print these days. I hope you read it. You've got it on papers, I assume. Clients, users, usually don't formulate their protection codes. You have an inner feeling of fairness, and somehow, or sometimes you feel cheated unfairly, but usually you don't formulate your protection codes. It's mainly consumer organizations who do that. But if you think it to the limit, if we start with enlightenment, that is, the single person is the actor, then the single person should formulate what his or her protection goals are. Of course, it's always nice if you hear consumer organizations with good proposals, ask you questions, did you think about this and that, etc., etc. Assuming the bank has formulated, and assuming the client has formulated, then in some sense you should negotiate. Because in the initial formulation, the bank will say all the risks go to the client and user. And of course, in the initial formulation, the user will say, okay, all the risk goes to the bank. So now you have to do some negotiation, some compromise. After you got a compromise, oh, first, in case you don't get a compromise, what does this mean? You can't do business with each other. This happens from time to time. Okay, but then you know that you better don't do business with each other, because at least one of you will be disappointed. And it's good if you know that before the fact. Assuming you got a compromise, then, of course, you should be able to enforce it. For example, in the legal system, this means everyone gets a record of actions which can be proved in front of a court, just to prove that you behaved according to the rules. Okay, so this was our definition and our rationale behind it of defining multilateral security. It was mainly work we did from 1994 until 1999. So this is the classical definition out of a larger project within Germany. Then I did some teaching here. And you will see, you will get an exercise. I ask you to come up with your own definition of multilateral security, because this is not a definition which I can cast into stone. If I say, hey, it's about security in a democratic society, I can propose a definition of multilateral security. But what security means, it's all of us deciding that. It's not me deciding. It's all of us. So it's important that you think about appropriate definitions. In the past, we started to do that. And we came up with two definitions more. And this is work, I think, of the last years. But the first change is in the first line. We started, our students said, hey, it's not just that different people have different protection goals, so this was this, but different people have different goals. It's not just about protection, it's about goals in general. And I have just to admit, yes, this is the case. And it's only in step two, when it gets about formulating something, that I have to insist that protection goals are formulated, because this is what I want to deal with security. But I have to admit, in the first step, it's not only about protection, it's about goals. Okay, this would be one generalization. And then I got another discussion about the last of the 4 points. And some people said, hey, what you write, each party can enforce its protection goals within the agreed compromise. Sounds nice. But can it really be done? Is there something like an absolute enforcement? And then, of course, I said, no. I always told you that nothing is absolute. And then the question back was, and why do you write it? And then I said, okay, you have got me. I should change that. So we come to a third version where the fourth statement gets longer. This is what I hate, but okay. So I can argue, maybe my first statement is slightly wrong, but it's shorter, and that's nice. Okay, the longer statement then is, each party can enforce its protection goals within the agreed compromise, and then the addition, as far as limitations of this cannot be avoided, they equally apply to all parties. So if limitations, then it's not just, again, one party bearing the risk or the limitation, but somehow the limitation is spread over all parties. So this is realistically the best we can hope for. Okay, do you want to discuss about multilateral security? You will get your homework anyway, so we'll have a discussion about that next week. But I'm open to all your questions and suggestions And maybe we are producing a fourth version. I'm open to it. See you.